Shalom and welcome everyone to the ICEJ webinar series brought to you by the International Christian Embassy Jerusalem. I'm your host, David Parsons, and we're glad you're joining us today. Over recent weeks, we've been covering some biblical teachings on Christian Zionism, a lot of interest in this subject because of the war here in Israel and the region, and we just wanted to revisit some things we've taught over the years post October 7 and try and inform a lot of Christians who are now curious about why we're standing with Israel and the whole biblical foundation of that. And we're going to have a few more teachings in that series, but we got to get back to the war, current events, because the ceasefire that held for several weeks got another 33 hostages, I believe, out. It has broken down. We're back to war. And we want to talk today about Israel's new strategy in Gaza. There's been a big shift. We're going to watch this, monitor it over coming weeks. But to help us understand what's going on, we have our friend, Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Conricus, retired now. He was reserve. He's retired now. Served in the Givati Brigade before joining the IDF spokesman's office. Jonathan was a prominent figure, a voice for the IDF and the country of Israel, the military here, on global media outlets for many years. And he was called up when the war started after October 7. As reserve, but has retired and is now a security analyst for the Israel Defense Security Forum and also a senior fellow with the Washington-based Foundation for the Defense of Democracies led by Clifford May. And good to see you, Jonathan. Great to have you with us today.
Thank you, David. Shalom. A pleasure to be here. And I look forward to sharing my perspective and maybe answering questions if that'll be possible, but really sharing my perspective of what's going on in Gaza as we speak. Lots happening, much at stake, and I think a lot of things to disambiguate in this conversation.
Now, can you give us a little rundown on how we got to a ceasefire? I think it was mid-late January when President Trump came in office. He was a big factor. And then how this broke down over recent weeks and the fighting resumed about 2 weeks ago. A lot of people blamed Israel, but what's your perspective on this?
Yeah, so it's really sadly, brutally simple. Hamas, when they invaded Israel on the 7th of October, beside the fact that they killed and murdered about 1,250 Israelis, ravaged communities, burned, mutilated, raped, and stole, etc. What they did, as we all remember, was that they took 252 people hostage, some of them foreign nationals, some of them dual nationals, Israeli and other nationalities. And we still have 59 Israeli hostages held in Hamas captivity. We're nearing the year and a half milestone, a grim, horrible, really tragic milestone for our hostages to be in Hamas captivity. Out of the 59 hostages, we assume, based on various sources of information, that between 20 and 24 of those hostages are still alive, and that Hamas is holding on to the bodies of the remaining hostages. So when you ask, how did we get where we are where we are in terms of ceasefire and the current situation, because Hamas is holding on to hostages, and that is strategic leverage over Israel that has prevented Israel from taking the decisive military action that it needs to take. It is those hostages and Hamas holding on to them and keeping them in a cruel captivity that has allowed Hamas to stay alive as a terrorist organization and as the governing sovereign entity in Gaza. Had it not been for hostages, I think that the war would have been over a long, long time ago. Hamas would have been relegated to the dustbin of history, and Israel would have moved on to secure its southern border and hopefully to bring about good developments for itself, for Israel, and also for Gazans. But that is not where we are. Hamas, I think, is emboldened and has been emboldened by Egyptian support. And when Hamas, when they assess the situation and when they scan the horizons and try to understand where they stand, then they know that they have almost unconditional Egyptian backing. And the Egyptian backing is perhaps the most important international diplomatic backing that Hamas needs. And the real decision here is, and the most important input of the Egyptians is, whether or not they will agree to open the Rafah gate and allow those Gazans who wish to leave the Gaza Strip, allow them to go out. So far, the Egyptians have refused for whatever political Machiavellian reasons. They have refused. I can assure you that the Egyptian refusal is not based on humanitarian concerns. It is not out of a concern for Palestinians or their well-being or their ability to survive the war or to be out of a combat zone. That is not what the Egyptians are focusing on. But they have closed the gate and prevented the Palestinian civilians from fleeing a battlefield. And that is very important for Hamas because Hamas knows that their game is a waiting game. They have a lever on Israel, and that is the hostages, and that really limits the military activities that Israel can do, because then they know that if Israel takes very significant action, then there could be very irreversible consequences for our hostages. And as long as Egypt continues to give Hamas the diplomatic, international, and military backing that they need, then we are kind of in a square situation which is difficult to breach out from. Israel, out of frustration from this stalemate, decided to continue negotiations, but by doing it also with military means. That is where we are now. That is what's happening now. That is what Israel initiated a few weeks ago. And that is what's going on today with new developments and new troop movements of Israeli forces that have gone into the southern part of the Gaza Strip and are operating into the northern part. That's where we are now. And that is the context of everything that's happening. This isn't yet a return to war. This is not yet a total breaking or discarding of negotiations. It is just negotiations by different means, by Israel, trying to apply pressure on Hamas, insinuating to Hamas that if you don't give back our hostages and agree to our terms, then we will take land and we will hold on to land and prevent Palestinians and Hamas from using it again. And that's a relatively new development, which of course we can discuss. But to summarize, bottom line here, we are, I think, Israel, out of a frustration with Hamas' continued refusal to negotiate and to agree with American proposals. The last proposal on the table is Witkoff's proposal, which Israel accepted. Hamas refused. I think Hamas are playing hardball because they have Egyptian support. The moment that they won't have Egyptian support, they will be forced to act very differently and not in such an obstinate and stubborn way as they're acting now.
It's very interesting the way you put the focus on Egypt as the fly in the ointment, a sticking point here, because I think most Israelis, most of us who support Israel, we're all pointing to Qatar and Al Jazeera and the money Qatar gave, and that's getting very complex now with the investigations into someone in the Prime Minister's office taking money to help promote Qatar in a good light. But you're focused on Egypt, which after all was coming together with a pan-Arab plan that made no mention of Hamas and would have left Hamas in de facto power in Gaza. So you're saying their protexia is coming from Egypt. That's quite interesting.
Yeah, David, you know, it's important to point out, you're very correct in what you say. There are dramatic developments and criminal investigations in Israel of officials, advisors in the prime minister's office for alleged involvement and dealings at the behest of the Qatari government, alleged payments that were made by Qatar to media advisors that were working for the prime minister. This is all being investigated as we speak, commonly referred in Israel to as Qatargate. And there should be no confusion. Qatar is an extremely hostile and negative force in the Middle East and in the world. They are proponents of the Muslim Brotherhood and of Muslim domination. They support, finance, and spread terrorism. Al Jazeera is perhaps the biggest inciter to jihadi terrorism in the world, and they have done tremendous damage for future generations and current generations in the Arab world, spewing out vitriol, hatred, and terror incitement on their airwaves and on their social media. I have almost nothing positive to say about neither the state of Qatar nor their propaganda outlet Al Jazeera. And of course, the fact that I focus on Egypt doesn't diminish even by an ounce the negative effect that Qatar has had on events. But I focus on Egypt because I think Egypt is getting away with murder. Murder of Palestinians. They are the ones who, in the beginning of the war, the first and second week after the massacre of October the 7th, Israel communicated via the Americans and also directly to Egypt that we are going to strike Hamas in Gaza. And what we ask you, out of a concern for the lives of Palestinians in Gaza, we ask you to open the gate at Rafah and to allow people out. It will make it easier for Israel to operate. And most importantly, it will spare the lives of Arab Muslims living in Gaza who have nothing to do with the fighting. And what Egypt did was not only to say no, but what they did was to launch a diplomatic offensive where they leveraged influence with the previous U.S. administration. And they said, no, nobody's going to cross Rafah. Two, we are against any Israeli operations in Gaza. And three, what they did on the ground was to immediately build a massive steel wall separating between the Gaza Strip and Egypt to reinforce their standing. That was a pivotal moment in the history of Gaza. Had the Egyptians allowed Gazans out then, we would have seen far fewer casualties, far fewer dead Palestinians, collateral damage, as we call it in military parlance, as a result of the fighting. And we would have seen less human suffering, and we would have seen a shorter, faster, and more decisive war. Egypt could have changed that reality, but Egypt chose, out of Machiavellian and very sinister considerations, not to open the gate, and they persist in not opening the gate. Now, to be frank, if we look at what's ahead, a few weeks ahead, maybe less than that, I think that an Israeli larger operation in Gaza is in the cards. I'm not entirely sure that it's imminent, but I think that it is close, and every day that goes by, we're getting closer to such an operation. If and when Israel launches such an operation, again, the real important infliction point will be whether or not civilians will be allowed to be evacuated from the battlefield. And I'd like to remind everybody watching, I know that I'm speaking to friends and people that aren't brainwashed by international mainstream media, but I'll say that, you know, the only military conflict in modern history where civilians were prevented from fleeing into safety from an active war zone, from a battlefield, is this conflict. The Egyptians, I think, have a black stain on their, they should have a black stain on their collective conscience. They could have saved many thousands of Palestinians. They could have prevented tremendous suffering, but out of cruelty and Machiavellian interests, they decided to keep the door shut, and they have not allowed Palestinians out. And I think that is something that Egypt should be criticized for, should pay a diplomatic price for. Egypt should be named and shamed, and Egypt should be called upon to do the right thing, and that is to allow Palestinian civilians who wish to leave, not any forceful removal of people, but people who wish to flee a combat zone, that has very little infrastructure, limited access to medical aid, and tremendous destruction of infrastructure, people who want to leave should be able to leave. And the fact that Egypt is stopping that from happening, I think, is a travesty. And I think that the fact that they're getting away with it is very regrettable, it's cruel, and it's not the right thing to do.
Yeah, I think you've put your finger on a really important decision that we have to remember. The whole international community endorsed this, and then Israel gets charged with genocide. And I've already said that the greatest proof there's no genocide, if it was, all nations who signed the genocide treaty from 1949 would have to take in Gazan civilians as refugees, because you're under obligation to rescue people from genocide. So it's actually proof that it's not going on, but it made Israel's battle a lot more complicated and harder to achieve its objectives. And this is a very good intro. I've got a map here. This is, I hope you can see it, this is the overall Gaza Strip. And this was the sort of the posture of the IDF during the ceasefire. They still maintained a security zone in the Philadelphia corridor near Rafah, all along the border for, I think, around 800 meters a kilometer in, all the way up to the north. And then I think probably up to the Saladin Highway, halfway through the Netzarim corridor there. And now, as you mentioned, there are these limited operations here in Rafah. There were mortars, or some, they saw Hamas activity here. There were mortars fired into Israel, so they're going in there. This is just within the past week. And then Jabalia as well, firing on, I think, Sderot. And these are the evacuation orders from the south. You see this lighter gray was the IDF positions during the ceasefire. They've now said all of Rafah flee into the Masawi area, the civilian protected area here near Khan Yunis. Here's the Khan Yunis again, this area. And then in the north, Jabalia, telling people to flee there. Anything you want to point out on these maps, and tell us about the new strategy that Defense Minister Israel Katz basically said, you know, the old way was to go in, deal with Hamas units that we saw, and then retreat, and not get caught up in static positions where you could get ambushed, but rather the IDF would be the guerrilla force. Now Israel says, as long as they're holding hostages, we're going to take territory and we're not letting it go. And the goal is security control over all of Gaza. This is basically the new strategy.
Yeah, I think your viewers get a very good understanding when you use those maps and you explain the reality on the ground, and that's a very good thing to do. You know, Minister Katz, he has said that, but I think we'll have to measure and assess those statements in a few weeks after we see reality on the ground, because in my mind, it is much more related to applying pressure on Hamas leadership. We know, we assess in Israel that they are sensitive to the loss of terrain, the loss of soil. Therefore, that's a pressure point, and that is what Minister Katz is talking about. Now, talks by, or things said by a politician, that's one thing. And I don't attribute too much weight to anything that any politician says. I look at what happens on the ground and reality on the ground, what the IDF does, how the enemy responds, and then I measure things. To really take control of soil, I mean, there's a military term for that, okay? When a military maneuvers in, takes territory, and intends to keep it, that is called to occupy. Occupy terrain is when you permanently go in and you hold on to the terrain with the strategic purpose of making it yours. I think for legal reasons, Minister Katz has been careful not to use that terminology, even though that is the correct military terminology that would reflect what Israel allegedly is doing, because he wants to stay clear of any legal issues, international law, and other types of condemnations on one hand. But on the other hand, he wants to send a message to Hamas that this is not more of the same. This isn't raids going in, executing tasks, going out, but this is something different. It remains to be seen if that is indeed reality, and if indeed Israeli troops will be deployed there for a long period of time in the areas where they are now deployed. We'll see that in a few weeks. I am not sure that this is the relevant pressure that needs to be applied on Hamas. I'm not entirely sure that they are very impressed with Israel taking a few square hundred meters and allegedly holding on to it. I'm not sure that that is the weakness or the soft spot that Israel needs to apply pressure on. I think that Hamas, when they assess their own situation, as long as they have food, as long as they have Egyptian backing, as long as they have fuel, and as long as they have hostages, and most importantly, as long as there isn't a ruling alternative to Hamas, then I don't think that they will be under much pressure, because, you know, for Israel, for an Israeli minister to say, we're going in and taking terrain, okay, so he said so. Troops are easily redeployed if they are ordered to do so, and if negotiations go forward. So I don't think it's a, I don't think that our enemies are very impressed with those statements. What they will be impressed with, I think, is if and when Israel goes in and not only takes a small part here and there, a neighborhood in Rafah, parts of northern Gaza, the Netzarim corridor, but when Israel does that on a large scale, goes in with three or four division combat teams, assaults all of the Palestinian cities, Gaza, Nusirat, Khan Yunis, and Rafah, goes in, takes control, and then holds on to that and starts to eradicate Hamas fighters, leaders, and infrastructure wherever they are in the Gaza Strip. Now, that's a military operation of significantly different dimensions. But I think that that is what Israel needs to do if it really is serious about complete victory and defeating Hamas. Anything short of that, if we don't have a divine miracle, but anything short of that will not deliver what Israel needs, and that is to get rid of the Hamas regime and to clear all of Hamas's infrastructure and to replace Hamas with another governing body in Gaza. And what I think Hamas draws security from is the fact that they don't yet see that alternative. Now, there's one thing that's happening, which I think our viewers should be aware of, which is important and could be influential for the future of Gaza. And those are the protests that Palestinians have been leading in various parts of the Gaza Strip, started in the northern part, Beit Hanun, Beit Lahia, and Jabalia, and they've been going on in the central part and even in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. We've seen spontaneous protests of Palestinians that are openly defying Hamas, calling for the removal of Hamas, calling for the release of the hostages, and begging for an end to the war. Now, let's be clear. The motivation of these protests are not humanitarian, and they are not peaceful, and they are not conciliatory to Israel. These are the same Palestinians that on the 7th of October were out on the streets jubilating in joy, massacring Israeli civilians, lynching them, raping, molesting, and harassing Israeli Israeli hostages that were brought in by Hamas terrorists. These are the same Palestinians. The difference is that today they are tired, hungry, they are desperate. They know that they have very limited future in Gaza, and they know that as long as Hamas holds on to the hostages, there will be absolutely no rebuilding of Gaza, and they will continue to suffer. So while I think that their protests are a good thing, and I wish them the best of success in getting rid of Hamas for my purposes and also for their own future, but I do not for a second believe that they are motivated by anything positive towards Israel. It's just a matter of the fact that they're suffering, and they know that they'll continue to suffer in the future. And of course, the heavy hand of tyranny and oppression that Hamas has been applying on the Gazan population in order to continue to govern and to rule it. So that's an important development that's happening. It still hasn't culminated into anything strategic, but the mere fact that Palestinians dare to protest against Hamas with uncovered faces, saying their name, where they come from, which family they belong to, and openly calling for the removal of Hamas, in the past, that was an extremely dangerous thing that would present mortal danger, torture, and persecution of the family of anybody who did such a thing. And I don't know what's going on now, but specifically the last few hours. If our viewers want to learn more about that, I can recommend a Twitter handle called the Center for Peace Communications, which brings authentic, real, corroborated videos of Palestinians speaking in Arabic from Gaza, telling people around the world what they feel and how desperate they are, not the kind of stuff that you'll see on Al Jazeera and CNN and BBC, but a different reality, a different narrative, where Palestinians say, we're sick and tired of Hamas, we want out of Gaza, we want the war to end because we're suffering and we didn't ask for this war to start.
Yeah, I think even Hamas was caught by surprise by some of these protests and allowed them to fester a few days, but they've started cracking down on it. And as of the last 24 hours or so, we haven't seen any of them taking place, the open marches in the street. But I think it proves the point. Israel has said, we're not sending any more aid in because Hamas is just taking it to use to control the people. I think it's proof the people know this and they're protesting against Hamas controlling the food supply, which is going to dwindle if the gates aren't open for more aid, and really brings up that issue. I also think it's very important the IDF stay in control of this Philadelphia corridor. Hopefully that cuts off the oxygen to Hamas in rearming. But what we've seen so far, it seems, people were saying, even, large media outlets and government saying Hamas has already recruited thousands of new troops and rearmed. But what we're hearing is that in most of these places where they're ordering evacuations, Hamas disappears. They're not ready for any direct confrontation for the IDF right now.
Yes, you're correct, David. They are, there's not no significant high level of combat so far. And I'm happy to say that we don't have any IDF casualties so far in the renewed operations. And I hope, of course, that continues. And I hope that our soldiers are able to complete their mission successfully and return to their bases and eventually return home after completion of their duties safely, safe in body and in spirit. Sadly, I don't think that that'll be the case. I think what we're talking about now is a strategic decision by Hamas to disengage. I'll remind everybody that Hamas, unfortunately, still has a significant network of tunnels under Gaza. And when they want to not to engage with Israeli troops, they simply do what rats do, hide underground in tunnels and wait for Israeli troops to pass, or simply just stay underground until it's safe to come out, or until they want to engage in battle. And that is where we stand now. I think it's more a matter of a tactical or strategic decision. Regarding recruitment of Hamas operatives that you referred to, Yes, I believe that to be true, that Hamas used humanitarian aid and the provision of food as leverage in order to coerce families to tell young male members, 15, 16, 17, 18-year-olds, to join the ranks of Hamas, and the condition, and of course, conditioning the supply of food for the family to that effect. That, by the way, was one of the reasons why the IDF decided that we are not going to continue to provide food and fuel to our enemy, and that it's quite a bizarre thing to be doing in war. So yes, Hamas has more thugs holding weapons. There's a question mark regarding their level of readiness and combat fitness. These are not Hamas terrorists that have had months and years to train and become proficient at the use of firearms and tactics. These are new recruits that have fancy uniforms. By the way, uniforms, they don't fight in their uniforms. Uniforms are for show. They are for TV opportunities, interviews on Al Jazeera, and for hostage release ceremonies. They are not for fighting. When Hamas terrorists fight, they fight in civilian clothes so that when they are killed, eventually, Hamas then counts them as civilians. Young male civilians and not as combatants. And then sadly, that lie is then carried by international media almost unedited and reported as truth. But bottom line here, Hamas, I think, is preparing itself for a confrontation with the IDF, a confrontation that I think it knows will happen because something has to give. Either Hamas agrees to the Witkoff deal and returns Israeli hostages, or Israel escalates the situation and we go towards military occupation and a real removal of Hamas from all of the Gaza Strip. But I again go back to the beginning. None of the, I mean, these are important things, but the most important thing is the diplomatic, economic, military pressure to be applied on Egypt. If Egypt agrees to open the gate and to allow a safe, orderly exit of Palestinians from the Gaza Strip, those who wish to do so, that would be a strategic game changer. Anything else is tactics and events that are important and crucial, but not really game changing. And I hope that Israel will have the wisdom to use its diplomatic tools available directly and indirectly in order to make that happen. I regret that it hasn't happened so far. I think that's a tremendous strategic oversight. And I think that we should really reevaluate our strategic relationship with Egypt. We see lots of hostile statements and actions coming from Egypt. We see a military buildup. Not only inside the Sinai, which is a different issue, but we see that the Egyptians have the largest standing military in the Middle East, much larger than the IDF. They have a modern military based on US fighting platforms. They have a navy, an air force, a very large ground forces. And when you look at the map of Egypt, you kind of don't understand why they would need it. Because to the west of Egypt is Libya. There's no military there capable of invading into Egypt. You look to the south, the Sudanese desert, no military significant threat there. Maybe guerrillas, maybe counterterrorism, but nothing that would need many armored divisions. And you ask yourself, why do the Egyptians need a big military, a big air force, and a big army? And that's a question that I think we haven't a asked ourselves and we haven't demanded an answer. Egypt has no territorial threats to its own sovereignty and to and it is suffering from significant economic pressure, yet they continue to finance a very large and costly military. And I ask myself, why? Why do they need that military? What are they thinking to use that military for? And what's their real stance and what are their real intentions? And I'm not positive when I assess the situation about them. So I think there's room to reconsider many things when it comes to Egypt. I think that The peace treaty with Egypt is a strategic pillar of Israel's foreign policy, important to maintain, important to nurture, and to make sure that it stays in place, as of course is our strategic peace with the Jordanians. But the fact that we have peace with Egypt doesn't mean that we have to be pushovers and to allow Egypt to have our lunch and continue to cause problems for Israel, which is what Egypt is doing without paying a price for it.
Yeah, there were a phone call at the start of this week between President Trump and President al-Sisi of Egypt. We haven't seen any sort of impact or change, but I wouldn't put it past Trump to say your $2 billion in aid from America as part of the Camp David Accords, the peace treaty, would be in jeopardy if you don't do something to help break this logjam. But we'll see if that phone call has any impact on the ground. But you're saying that since the ceasefire ended, Israel's strategy, the Netanyahu government, its priority is still trying to put enough military pressure along with diplomatic pressure, help from the U.S., maybe economic pressure, to get the last hostages free. That's still the priority. But it's backed by the threat, we'll take more territory and keep it from now on if you don't release the hostages. That's the sort of standing where we are, and it could last through maybe Passover, but we don't see a large mobilization of Israeli forces yet. All the reserves who are already exhausted, lost jobs, everything. We don't see that mobilization yet to really go in and take control of large parts of Gaza.
Yeah, maybe I'll just tweak that definition a little bit. To be honest, I am not entirely convinced that that is what the Israeli government is doing. And I have my questions about the priorities and tactics and strategy of what the Israeli government is doing. I think what's going on are negotiations in offices and on the ground using military tools. But I am not happy with the pace of these negotiations. I think that every day that goes by is a day that is wasted for our Israeli hostages. And it's another day that creates more insecurity as long as Hamas is in place. And I think that I would expect more urgency on behalf of the Israeli government to win the war and to defeat Hamas and get our hostages back. And I don't see that. I see lots of bravado statements by politicians. We refer to a few of them in this conversation. But I don't see the decisive action that I think is needed in order to win the war and get our people back. And I regret that. I think there should be more decisive action. It should be clear, and more pressure, real pressure should be applied on Hamas in order to surrender and to hand over our hostages. And I don't see that happening.
So you're in this camp. I think I first heard it from Gadi Taub, who's been on our webinar. He said, in Islam, in Hamas mentality, if you are weak and start losing territory, then you go to a hudna, ceasefire, a truce, because you can't lose territory that was once under Sharia law or under Muslim rule, and that it is the pressure of Hamas losing ground in Gaza that would create the opening for these last hostages. That's the way you defeat Hamas. I heard you say something earlier about that, and I've heard this from several of our Israeli analysts. And it's an interesting thought. It's proven true elsewhere.
Yeah, but then if you really want to do that, then you have to actually do it on the ground. And,
Yes.
it looks different when a military goes in and occupies terrain. It looks very different from when a military goes in and is in temporary positions. It's a totally different posture, different logistics, different infrastructure, different rules of engagement, and it's a different thing altogether. I do not see that yet. I see political statements that are not reflected on the ground in reality. And talk is cheap, but action is what matters. And for really to take control of territory, if you want the territory to matter, then you have to go and take the assets that are important to the enemy. Agricultural land in the outskirts of Gaza and cities, that is not what's going to hurt Hamas. Gaza City, Khan Yunus, the birthplace of the Sinwar family, Yahya and Muhammad, and the city of Rafah, those are important assets. And if you mean business, then that is where the IDF needs to go in order to apply real pressure, not political pressure for the sake of statements in TV, but real pressure on Hamas to go in and make it hurt. That is what needs to be done, and that hasn't been done yet.
Yeah. Jonathan, it's good to hear you being so candid when you still wore a hat for the IDF and spokesman, a sort of face of the Israeli military. You had to have certain decor and decorum, but you're being very blunt in your assessment. We really appreciate it because you have this experience as all these decisions made from your time in the IDF. Is this debate we're talking about full blown? Go, you know, it's taken months and months and months, a slow war compared to Hezbollah in the north. Why isn't it going faster in Gaza? And the debate, you know, do you go take the territory, defeat Hamas, or do you go cautiously to preserve the life of the hostages? This debate is going on in the IDF itself.
It is. It's a debate in Israeli society, and it's a debate that's going on in the defense establishment. And again, I'll be blunt and very straightforward. I think that's an equation, hostages and winning the war, that is very difficult or perhaps even impossible to square. I don't think that we can achieve both things fully. And very sadly, regretfully, I think that Hamas will never relinquish the all of the live hostages as long as they can as long as they can afford it, and the kind of impossible catch 22 situation we have here is we're demanding that Hamas give over the hostages, and we're also saying that we are going to remove Hamas from power and end Hamas. When Hamas listens to that, then they say, well, I don't agree with that, and I'm not going to hand over the hostages because I don't want my rule over Gaza to end. So it's kind of a catch-22 situation where something has to give. And I've been hoping and praying for Israeli hostages to be repatriated to their loved ones, those who are alive for recovery, those that have been murdered cruelly, brutally by Hamas, to be buried in the land of Israel by their families, in a proper Jewish burial, and come to rest to a final resting place. I've been praying and hoping for that for a year and a half. But sadly, when I look at this through cold military strategic eyes, I don't understand how we can square this equation and have everything that we hope for. And currently, what we are doing, in my mind, is wasting time. We're not achieving the return of hostages, and we are not decisively defeating the enemy. And if our politicians speak about a complete victory and to defeat Hamas and get Hamas out of Gaza and uproot all of the evil and tyranny that they brought with them, then by all means, let's do that. But the way to do that is not by making statements in the media. It is by ordering the IDF to go in and to attack Hamas in the centers of Gazan cities, to lay siege to the Gaza Strip, and to force Egypt to open the gate so that civilians who do not want to be in a horrible battle space are able to evacuate. If that doesn't happen, then lots of window dressing and very little results. And I can, you know, only imagine the anguish and pain that the families of the hostages are going through when they don't see any developments. They don't see their people, their loved ones being brought back home, and they don't see significant action on the ground. And I can understand their frustration. Of course, everything is also politicized, and many of the topics are hijacked for political purposes. There are political organizations that are leveraging the suffering of the hostage families in order to weaken the government, and there are parties of the coalition that are using the ongoing war as a political tool. Lots of political things going on that I, as an observer, just see and regret. But bottom line, if Israel is serious about winning the war and defeating Hamas, then there's ways to do it. We are not doing that yet.
I think sometimes we forget that Israel has been able to secure the release of about 150 of the 250 plus hostages. You have some that are bodies. They were taken in already dead, but about two dozen at the most living hostages that we're still fighting for. But Hamas would probably, they'd stick this out for years. They'd say we can ride this out for years, and if Israel doesn't change the strategy, I think you make a very good point there. I think we're going to have to rename this show Jonathan Conricus' new strategy for Gaza, and not necessarily Israel, because you say it still hasn't quite shifted into a more aggressive taking over the Gaza Strip and just rooting out all of Hamas. Yeah,
I mean, David, it's not my strategy. It's there's lots of people in Israel with various different backgrounds, military, diplomatic, who, I want to call balls and strikes, and to speak very sincerely and to be serious, because this is an extremely serious matter. And I don't think it is becoming to, talk in slogans and to be not to be really honest about what's going on. And I think that once we will see a new strategy happening, and once it'll be reality on the ground, then I will be the first one to support it and acknowledge it. And of course, I will hope for its success, and I will help defend it in international media. But I don't think that we're there yet. I regret that. And I think that it's, tremendously important for people watching this not to fall victim for lots of biased information in international media and shallow analysis of what's going on. A lot of people talk about a lot of things, and not everything is very responsible and based on facts, but a lot of interest and spins. When I look forward here, we haven't spoken about it, and I know it's not the name, that's not the topic of our talk, but I think we would be remiss if we didn't speak about Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, and the fact that everything that we've spoken about now for almost an hour, it goes back to, almost all of it goes back to Iranian money, Iranian weapons, and Iranian political incentives. And the general situation in the Middle East of terrorism and the threat of nuclear military capabilities is directly connected to that specific regime, the Iranian regime. And I think that we're coming near decision time here. I think that the window of opportunity that Israel has to significantly improve its national security and to prevent Iran from ever becoming a nuclear military power, that window of opportunity, according to what I understand, is closing. And Israel will be presented with a very clear dilemma or clear decision to be made. When will Israel take action against Iran? We have witnessed 15 years, 15 plus years of international diplomacy that have brought us to a situation where the Iranian regime is extremely close, according to Western experts, of achieving nuclear weapons. That's a reality that I do not want to live in, and I think we should do everything in order to prevent it. And I think that weakening Iran, weakening the regime, and taking out their most important weapons program is an extremely important goal to accomplish. And I think failure to do so would be something that we will regret for generations. And I'll just end by saying that there are three American presidents, two Democrats and one Republican, who have said and committed to the fact that Iran will never become a nuclear military power. Obama, Biden, and President Trump. They've all said it. President Trump even put it in writing in the Jerusalem Declaration, where he committed to using all elements of American national power in order to prevent Iran from ever achieving nuclear military capabilities. Now is that time, according to what I understand. And once Iran is dealt with militarily, and I hope diplomatically and financially, then I think we will see a much, much better situation in the Middle East that will herald in security, stability, prosperity, and good neighborly relations. I dare perhaps even say peace. I hope for that, and I yearn for that, so that all of the people in this area, Jews, Arabs, Muslims, of course, Christians living here, can flourish and focus their creative talents not on war and not on defending themselves, but on building better futures for our children. And as long as the Iranian regime is around, not happening. And I think we're really getting close to decision time to change that trajectory.
I totally agree with you. The sooner they defeat Hamas in Gaza, the better. It'll be a big victory for Israel, help improve its deterrence again. But that looming in the background is the Iranian nuclear threat. And who knows, we may wake up one morning to reports that the U.S. Alongside Israel is taking care of that issue, the Iranian nuclear program. And we should be watching for that in the days ahead. Thank you, Jonathan Conricus, former IDF spokesman, now with the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies and in Israel, the Israel Defense and Security Forum, two important think tanks, security, other issues they deal with. Great having you on the webinar today, and all the best.
Thank you, and thank you for the excellent and very important work that you and the organization does, David. Always a pleasure to be part of it.
Yeah. Okay, that's our time for today. We hope you've enjoyed it. We'll join you next week, bringing you another ICEJ webinar. God bless you from Jerusalem.